Let me tell you guys that
right.
I'm
so we can start here. So I guess we're back at this would be, if I'm not mistaken, episode 53 of the Financial Independent Podcast. And today we're joined with, if I'm properly pronounced, it's Jeremy Dembo, right?
That's correct. Jeremy Dembo.
Who is joining us with the beautiful view of Miami. This is going to be on audio only, so I'll leave it up to imagination for the listeners. But Jeremy, pleasure to have you here. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Nice. So do you mind introducing yourself a little bit to the audience?
Sure.
I know you did you're a Harvard graduate, Master of Finance, CEO of your own company, and you know, a lot of professional experience, but yeah.
Absolutely. So I met you originally a couple of months ago at a tech conference that I organized here in the Financial District of Miami. It was called AI 2027. We had about 30 folks who were CEOs of tech company startups and you know, some companies that are already publicly traded. We had some VC in attendance as well. And it was a look at artificial intelligence from the perspective of what are funded, you know, uses of AI, what are like cash positive uses of AI. So it was not academic, it was more focused on commercial, you know, use of AI. Now I'm CEO of two companies. One's a Delaware corporation, one's a California corporation. California corporation, Dembo LLC, is a consulting firm. And I guess we've got about seven figures with the contracts over the last like year and a half, 2 years in California. Now the Delaware company Air AI is a software company and it's using artificial intelligence to accelerate real estate transactions, both rental and purchase. And so essentially you could take out your phone and scan the skyline with the app open and machine learning, it's like facial recognition for buildings. Machine learning will recognize the skyscraper. Then you just, you know, tap to connect with the broker and it'll show you what's available to rent, what's available to purchase, and tap for the broker and we can put you into that unit as a tenant or to buy. And then of course, Air AI takes a percentage of the commission. And so that's the basic business model of that use case for our software. Let's see. I moved out here from California, spent some time in the Bay Area, spent some time in the Los Angeles area. Love Miami. And I live in the financial district. So it's called Brickell. And it's just a hub. It's an international hub, kind of a gateway to Latin America and a great place for tech now.
Yeah, that's I definitely agree. It's kind of like my feeling when I went to Miami was that it was like a New York in a tropical storm, at least the Brickell part of it.
Yeah.
Very clean, very organized. A lot of people from all kinds of places, very international. And the good part of it is it's sunny most of the year, right? So,
like every day. Yeah. Even if it rains, the sun still comes out, you know, it seems like every day. And, you know, temperature in the 80s is really fantastic. You know, you get in the ocean in January. I mean, it's just year round, very livable.
Yeah, if you go into the ocean in January in Massachusetts, I think probably wouldn't be having this conversation, right?
You definite hypothermia, right?
So, yeah,
California is like that. I mean, even when the temperature is perfect, the water's just so cold.
Right.
I love Miami and I think it's a great place to live, but I also think it's a great place to build a business. So this is kind of like a New York feel, the Financial District of Miami, because essentially you can walk out the front door and, you know, you got 200 restaurants that are within walking distance. You got multiple grocery stores that are within two or three blocks. You know, it's a great lifestyle. Yeah.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the AI conference, AI 2027 was great. And you just did a great job of moderating. There were people from different kind of backgrounds, different kinds of questions. And I was very impressed with like your ability to actually moderate the conversation between people that are different businesses, but still using AI and kind of having a similar thread there. So that was I really enjoyed that conference. Since we're here to talk about financial markets in this exciting time. Could you tell us how you got into finance?
You know, originally when I went into finance, I was thinking, you know, I want to get better at day trading. I want to get better at managing my own portfolio. You know, I did go into consulting, obviously, like straight out of college, and that was great. But I felt like I really wanted to run my own company. Now, a lot of what we do in consulting is financial consulting, and it's essentially the finance side of project management for 9- and 10-figure projects. So a lot of these are like state or federally funded, and you know, and then you have to obviously like be doing the financial tracking and the financial management in a way that'll get you through multiple audits. Whether it be EY or OIG, you know, and so that's sort of where I built my bread and butter. I think finance is, I think there's tremendous opportunity there. You know, I think there's tremendous opportunity in fintech and also in just the finance side of project management. So it's certainly an area I found myself comfortable.
Interesting. So I think we can jump into it straight away. The storm. So I think recently we all, but like the people who follow the markets, we're well aware that, you know, we have a little issue with inflation. I think for the maybe last year and a half or 2 years, there was a big print of like, oh, the inflation is going to be transitory. Don't worry about it. It's going to pass. It happened in the past, happened in 2008 or 2010, you know, because 3% print, it's going to pass. It's not going to stick around. But it seems like, you know, as the time passes by, the inflation seems very persistent, which has had, intended consequences on the market, as it seems that the Fed is, you know, following and is a little bit late with their reaction. How would you rate the Fed's reaction to what has currently happened? Or the macroeconomic environment?
I think a lot of people feel like they're like, you know, like a year and a half late on raising rates. I think that they maybe were guided into not raising rates or pressured into not raising rates for quite a while for political reasons. Obviously, you start raising rates, you're going to start like dropping the stock market. You're going to start like hitting, mortgage rates. And, you know, and so you start to see a lot of like real world implications of government policy or Fed policy. And I think why maybe the, you know, from the top down, the administration was sort of hoping this inflation thing would just be, in and out overnight, or, you know, that it'd be a brief phenomenon rather than something more structural. I absolutely think the Fed was late on that. But I also think, you know, there's other things they can do besides just raising interest rates. I mean, raising interest rates doesn't if this is a supply side issue, you know, it's not the number of cargo ships out that the ports are unloading them at. And so I think sometimes the challenge is that the Fed has a few tools that they use, which may be more or less relevant depending upon the situation we're in. It seems sort of ironic to me that the Federal Reserve would think, okay, well, the solution to this inflation, which we're saying is a supply side issue, if one of the issues is that the ports aren't unloading things fast enough, you know, and we've just got all these cargo ships parked offshore, then changing interest rates doesn't change that. And when you look at things like fuel prices, this is sort of a different animal. You know, I think, for example, large projects in California, debris removal and so on, you might have 1,000 dump trucks running at the same time. So you think to yourself, look, if the price of diesel triples, this is really going to affect your operational cost. And companies may have bid something already to revisit because that was based upon fuel prices last November, you know. And it's the same thing with everything else, right? Let's say we're moving cargo and we're saying like, well, you know, like there's this issue with the inflation and the price of goods. Well, if you're moving it on a cargo ship that runs on diesel and the price of diesel just doubled or tripled, then, you know, you would expect that shipping rates would increase, right? So I think what we're dealing with is it's a different phenomenon from just saying, hey, rates were low, so people were buying a lot. We had a bunch of demand. I think what we're seeing is something more nuanced, and that success is going to come from a more nuanced response.
Interesting. So yeah, I think that's the debate currently. There was also the two sides of things. One, as you mentioned, is the supply side, meaning that we're just having issues, whether it's the war in Ukraine preventing exports from Ukraine and food exports and oil embargo on Russia and whatnot. Or on the other side, whether it's the printing of money that we printed a lot of money to make sure that we don't go into depression during COVID, and everybody started spending, and everybody remembers the checks that were coming in and the stocks that were popping. I had friends that made a lot of money in the stock market as well, just with like government checks and whatnot. And it's a two-sided kind of equation. And this is the question. Do you worry that since, you said it's not only a demand side, and when we say demand side, it's like meaning that basically when you increase the interest rates, the availability of the money is, that money becomes more expensive. If you want to get a mortgage, the mortgage rates are higher. So maybe you're going to decide not to do so and not going to buy a house and the prices go down. That's just an example. But do you think that because the Fed cannot resolve the supply side of things, do you think that there's a strong chance that they'll have to have a much bigger impact on the demand side to overcompensate for what's on the supply side?
So what I think is going to happen here, and I already feel like myself writing a little caveat here. I'm not offering financial advice. Don't trade upon the next series of statements I'm making. But I believe that what's likely to happen here is that the Fed is likely to keep raising interest rates until it's obvious that they've broken the stock market. At which point they may start to furiously backpedal, and here comes some quantitative easing, and here we're lowering rates. And Larry Summers said he felt like you needed to see rates go high enough to generate 10% unemployment for a period of 1 year. So if you read into that, then one might say, based on what Larry Summers said, that maybe we're talking about what if unemployment went to 20% for 6 months, right? Or somewhere between 5 and 7% for 2 years. And I think these are the ways that we could sort of try to chart out some parameters for what we think we might be sailing into. I think it's a perfect storm. There are multiple factors that are affecting these markets. So, for example, with oil and with gas, it's not just that there's sanctions on the trade of oil from certain nations to include Iran, Venezuela, and Russia. It's not just that we're now seeing sanctions on Russian oil. I think the issue is more nuanced, which is that I read some article that said we haven't had a refinery built in America since the 1970s. At some point, refining capacity might be the bottleneck here. And, it certainly makes sense to look at something like nationalization or some sort of federally funded, domestic energy policy that includes green lighting, more refinery capacity being built or brought online. And that's going to require a real forward-facing perspective. I know politics, sometimes people are looking very short-term, but if you want to look out over the next 10 years, 20 years, I think you have to start out with an understanding that, and I own a Tesla. I own an electric vehicle, right? But the most that Tesla can do is build 1 million vehicles a year. Well, if you got 286 million cars in America, then, windmills isn't going to change the price of gas, right? I mean, they can't use that fuel source. And so you have to look at how can you control the price of gas? How can you bring the price of gas down in the U.S.? And I think it comes to bringing more refinery capacity online, which isn't going to happen overnight, or maybe importing more gas from abroad, right? But interest rates doesn't change that, right? And so I think we could look at improving operational efficiency at ports to deal with that supply side thing, which again, I think it's a case of putting public dollars at use into something like increasing train lines in and out of ports, automating the ports so that they can unload container ships faster, running things 24/7 instead of, you know, on these lesser schedules. And so my hope is that in a lot of ways that the government will get more hands-on in terms of trying to build out some of these capacity issues, rather than using, I guess, what the folks at Porsche Consulting might call more indirect levers, right? Moving interest rates up and down, is not really directly affecting something like the number of cargo ships parked offshore. You know, we had that issue with the China lockdown. So, you know, they couldn't move stuff in and out of China, and all these cargo ships were basically just parked offshore waiting for that to open back up, right? And then we've got stuff over here that's just like parked offshore waiting to be unloaded. I was at the port of Miami the other day, just kind of looking at operations there. And it seems like, you know, anytime you're from the outside looking in, I don't know that you see all the details, but it just seemed like a situation where things could be running faster, right? And that's a matter of operational efficiency. So you start looking at, can you automate unloading of cargo? Can you run 24/7 instead of on, you know, an 18/6, you know, can you work Sundays and Saturdays as opposed to taking those days off, and then building the infrastructure that moves it out of there? For example, truck drivers, getting more trucks, more drivers, right? You know, and so I think it's that big picture infrastructure stuff that, you know, is needed.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think in terms of, I think you pointed out very important points, and I would say probably the only effect that, you know, the Fed could have with raising interest rates is maybe on people's wages and companies, that the cost of capital goes up, and the companies, you know, we all know that it's much tougher these days to raise money than when it was a year ago. You know, the valuations are slowly starting to tank. I think I saw today that one of the companies, I can't remember which one, but they raised at $7 billion. There was the valuation, and I think 6 months ago they were at 45. So a lot of companies are taking haircuts, and I completely agree, you know, in terms of oil and whatnot. And it seems like it's a result of, I guess, years of policy, where there was policy in place that kind of was, the subsidies was going in the direction of, you know, solar and wind, and these companies, they were oil companies, kind of saw that the policies progressively were more and more aggressive against them, and they stopped spending money in, you know, capital expenditures and the research and development, and they stopped digging holes and you know, digging for oil. And from what I've heard, the only problem there is that even if you start now, it takes, you know, I don't know, 5 to 10 years to create a refinery or something, and to establish the process. And here's the question. Do you think, because the decision you said, if there's a federal push for it, do you think that's possible? And not to get too political, but I don't see a Democrat kind of pushing for that. That would be like a political suicide, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that a lot of times there's a hesitancy to do things themselves. You know, whether you're talking about a local municipality all the way up to the federal government, that they're much more likely to say, let's put together a contract and push it out. We'll get a contractor and consultant, and they'll do this thing for us. And that they're very hesitant to say, hey, we're going to send in the National Guard. We're going to like build this ourselves. We're going to like, the government is going to take a much more active role in building a bridge or building a highway or building a refinery. Right. And so I think that's certainly a challenge. There are other governments out there that have taken a more hands-on role. I mean, obviously the UK, it used to have a lot of nationalized industries, from the airlines to petroleum. You know, there's other Western European countries that have nationalized petroleum companies. But I think one of the biggest challenges here, I think you really hit the nail on the head, is that the Federal Reserve can basically like put assets on their balance sheet. They could buy mortgage-backed securities. They could buy treasury bonds. So they can unload those positions. They can raise interest rates and they can lower interest rates. But it's not really their place to dive into this other area. You know, and that's something that, you know, would have to be, you know, that they'd have to determine that there was a national interest But certainly we've seen that in the past during wars. We've seen the National Defense Production Act used to sort of take over airplane manufacturers or vehicle manufacturers. And I don't think they've gone into the petroleum industry per se, but up to now, but just sort of thinking out loud on that. And I do think that I'm an optimist by nature, and I do think there's tremendous potential out there. And while we are looking at interest rates rising, and interest rates rising increase the cost of capital, and they typically lead to layoffs, and they make it harder for companies to raise money, and they reduce the market cap for companies who have distant future revenue, right? So you do see some market distorting effects from raising interest rates. All of a sudden, companies that are not cash positive right now, that are not profitable right now, could really see a haircut in terms of what are they worth net present value today. Once you apply this like increasing interest rate to the, the discount rate formula, right? But I still believe that it's possible to build great companies in America that are cash positive. I think that there is still a lot of capital out there looking for a good deal. And that a lot of it comes down to trying to build something that, clearly could run with or without investor capital. I mean, sometimes I think the things that people want to put money in the most, these are companies that feel like, well, we're already making a profit, So we could potentially just run this thing, on revenue, right? And then become less in need of buying enough cash from investors to build out a runway to try to get off the ground. Even today, I was looking at some stuff, and I feel like there are still some tremendous investments out there. And the increasing interest rates, certainly affect profitability, make it harder to pick a winner. But I think there's some amazing opportunities out there. And I've been pleasantly surprised to see people still raising a lot of capital in this environment. I think for the right deal, there's money available.
I agree. And I think, to your point, I think with easy money and capital available, I think, when drugs were everywhere, everybody became a junkie, I guess, and everybody could start a company that maybe doesn't even make sense, but there's just so much money available. And now we're seeing the trend go the other way. And speaking about easy money and junkies and drugs and whatnot, I think a good example, of the industry that's going through its first stages of this and like a learning experience in my mind, and I'm a believer in it, is crypto. And I know we have about 9-10 minutes left, but what are your opinions of what's feels like crypto is currently going through a, I feel like we are lucky that it's not so big because it would be systemic because it's not regulated. Because we saw so many blowups, it seems like it's like a microcosm of like 2008 and 2009 that was like happening with the banks. Currently it's happening inside of the small crypto market. What do you think about that? And do you think that crypto should be regulated given what we have seen currently?
Well, that's a great question. I want to thank you for asking it. I think like one of the reasons why crypto works is because it isn't regulated, right? I mean, it's not essentially like, already controlled by, regulatory agencies or big banks or whatever. It's not like like the Federal Reserve issues some e-dollar or something like that, and I think like crypto has some really compelling use cases. I mean, right now there's a lot of countries on earth that have capital controls, and it's very hard to, you might have money there, but it's hard to get that money out, and particularly as people start to worry about travel restrictions or capital controls, or even things like the deflation in the value of their currency, the crypto, it can pose some like compelling options. I think It's unlikely to be regulated in any kind of significant way because I think some governments love it and some governments hate it, you know? And so it becomes an issue where if it's helpful to the US government for crypto to exist, because that causes, you know, for example, complications for, you know, some other countries with capital controls in place, right? Then sometimes it becomes an issue where some governments want it to succeed and other governments want it to fail, right? And any time you have that sort of a positioning, I think you know, and until they've all turned against it, I think it's got a bright future, right? And now I do think that it took a big hit, right? And I used to have a huge crypto position, which I exited before this turbulence. But if you look at the big picture, right, and you're getting this from a guy who's very optimistic, right? March 2020, crypto crashed to like, I think it was like $3,500 per Bitcoin, right? So had you just said, looks like the sky's falling, I'm going all into Bitcoin at like $4,000 a coin, right? And then you ride this thing up to 65 grand a coin, right? And then it crashes back down to 20K. Did you really get screwed on this deal? I mean, you 5X'd, you know? And it seems like we've leveled off in this 18 to 20K range. And I think, like, you know, and there's a million coins and everything, and there's this all kinds of issues with, like, what's your, you know, gas cost on Ethereum and this kind of thing. I think, like, the only ones I ever owned were Ethereum and Bitcoin, sort of the two giants in the crypto space. But I do think there's like tremendous potential there. I think one challenge though is that a lot of people were into these things on leverage and they were chasing a trend and they bought a position that they're underwater on, and they may get like margin called out of it at a loss. So I think it's been a very volatile space, and you know, that said, I don't think it's going away anytime soon. And I think the two monsters, to use that Malcolm Gladwell perspective, the two monsters that have this enormous head start advantage would be Bitcoin and Ethereum. And I expect that to continue.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those. I'm on the side of, I'm a believer of crypto in general. I think that Bitcoin, the crypto space is, just because it's new, I think it's a good example of what happens when you flush a lot of capital into the markets. And, you know, we're really going to see what are the right protocols now, what are the proper business models, who is not a scammer, and stuff like that when the money dries up a little bit. And I think, as well as you, like, I think Bitcoin, you know, Ethereum, and projects ultimately that actually are doing something, because there are a lot of projects out there that, you know, if something is good, it shouldn't be that hard to explain. Usually the good things are pretty easily explainable. And every time, like, somebody's explaining you something and making you feel like, you know, you don't really understand because of this and that. Well, I'm not, at least personally, I'm like, well, not really sure about that, but interesting. So I think we have about 3 minutes. So I would say, in terms of the next year, Where do you see us a year from now? Are we up or are we down on the markets? What do you say? And this is not investment advice, guys.
I think we'll be on the other side of inflation pretty quickly. What I expect is that it'll be declared a recession pretty soon, because I think Q1 and Q2 of 2022, we were looking at like a net decline in GDP, which is the definition of recession. So what I would expect is that it's going to be officially a recession, you know, as soon as those numbers come in, and they call it that way. I think inflation, you know, is going to be a bit challenging to beat, but I expect that we'll have beat it within the next, like, say, 12, 18, 24 months. I think the stock market is going to fight back pretty strongly here. And something I thought was interesting was, yes, we created a lot of new money in the U.S. There's a lot more dollars now than we had a few years ago. And you know, one might think, gee, if there's a lot more dollars than we had before, it's not backed by anything, it should dilute. But when we look at things like the exchange rate against the euro, for example, it's actually at darn near the best exchange rate of dollars to euros in the history of the euro. I mean, I think we're at that point where you're about to be able to buy a euro for less than a dollar, which is interesting. And after COVID, I mean, markets got hammered, right? But they bounced back so fast. And maybe some of that was a flood of low interest and capital being injected in the system by the Fed and, you know, and the administrations. But I think that this horse wants to run. And we're going to see it take a hit, you know, and certainly I think right now, like with the stock market, a lot of people are maybe at like maximum pessimism, right? But I wouldn't be surprised at all to see this thing run like over the next year or 2 years. Yeah, I think markets will recover relatively quickly, and they will sell through this storm in like, let's say, 12 to 24 months, maybe less.
Interesting. I think historically, I think I've saw a number somewhere. Historically, even when the inflation is declining, even from like high numbers of like 12, as long as it's declining, usually the markets, since they're, you know, forward-looking machine, usually rise on any kind of inflation declines. This was a pleasure. We have less than a minute. Is there anything that you would like to a message for the younger listeners who are just going into finance? Or investing, or any other message?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, we all wish we had like a time machine, right? You could be like, hey, I'm just going to pop back 18 months and buy this condo in the financial district, and now I double my money in it, you know, this kind of thing. But I think sometimes the best time to start a company, right, is today. And I think that there's tremendous opportunity out there. And while I agree we're sailing through stormier seas, I believe that, you know, the world is your oyster.